Music has a special way of touching our hearts in ways many things cannot. And if you're tuning into this podcast, you probably think so too. On each episode of Classical Post, we uncover a creative mind behind music we find particularly exceptional. Coming to you from New York, Classical Post is created and produced by Gold Sound Media, a marketing and PR agency for the performing arts industry. I'm your host, Jonathan Eifert, creative director at Gold Sound Media, and I hope you find something inspiring in this episode. When Justin Austin isn't singing at the Metropolitan Opera, Kennedy Center, or Lincoln Center Theater, you're likely to find him shooting hoops on the basketball court. Sports have been a lifelong passion for the young baritone, but it's more than the game's physical benefits that keep him reaching for a basketball. To Austin, cultivating the mindset of an athlete has consistently helped him reach new heights as an artist. His disciplined approach to practice and role preparation has helped Austin land repeat engagements on some of classical music's biggest stages, including Carnegie Hall, where on March 5th, he's presenting a recital with pianist Howard Watkins. Part of Carnegie Hall's ongoing festival, Fall of the Weimar Republic, Dancing on the Precipice, this recital, titled Don't Be Angry, presents music by five composers written over the course of a century, from selections from Kurt Weill's Three Penny Opera to the New York premiere of Ricky Ian Gordon's Marvin Gaye Songs, which Gordon composed for Austin. In this episode, Austin and I talk more about his upcoming recital and how he hopes the program helps audience members become more comfortable with feelings of anger and hopelessness during turbulent times. Plus, he shares what it was like to return to the Metropolitan Opera stage after pandemic lockdowns, why opera singers should spend some time honing their acting skills, and the Outkast album he would need with him if stranded on a desert island.
My name is Justin Austin. I'm an American baritone born in Germany. I am the product of two professional international opera singers. I identify as Black, and my career consists of recitals, oratorios, and opera.
If you could collaborate with any artist, dead or alive, who would it be?
Luciano Pavarotti.
If you could go back in time to witness any historical musical event, which one would you choose?
Any performance of Luciano Pavarotti.
What's your musical or non-musical guilty pleasure?
Cheetos.
You're stranded on a desert island and can only take one piece of music with you. What would it be?
The Love Below.
If you weren't a musician, what profession would you be in?
Sports.
Which movie do you wish you could have composed the soundtrack for or performed on it?
DreamWorks, The Prince of Egypt.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Teleportation.
What's the first thing you do in the morning?
I read scripture.
Which city in the world inspires you the most?
New York City.
What book are you currently reading or would recommend?
Breath by James Nestor.
Which historical figure would you love to have dinner with?
Jesus. Oh, this makes me sound like a Jesus freak, but Jesus.
As a child, what did you dream of becoming?
An opera singer.
What's your go-to comfort food?
Chicken wings.
Is there an unusual or rare instrument you'd love to learn to play?
The didgeridoo.
Share the story behind one of your most significant performances.
I think probably the most significant performance for me was, it was the first performance of the Metropolitan Opera after the COVID shutdown. And it was highly anticipated and it was very intimate. At the same time, it was a performance that the whole world would eventually see because it was captured on film. And it was featuring Stephen Costello, Eric Owens, Angel Blue, and myself. And for most of the world, including myself, you know, we were all wondering, what am I doing in there? And Will Liverman was supposed to be there and sort of represent the future of the Metropolitan Opera. And he was not, he was unavailable. And I had been hired that coming season to cover him. So they asked if I could fill in for him for this opening concert. So I did. And it ended up being a really special moment for me, a pivotal moment for me in my career, but also a pivotal moment for my kind of thought process around performing. And I my values changed after that performance. It was, as I said, right after the pandemic or right after the shutdown. And because of, you know, obvious reasons, there were no barbershops open at the time. And I usually kept my hair, I usually keep my hair really short, but because there were no barbershops open, my hair was really long at the time. And I had to basically give this performance with this huge afro and that I was a little insecure about, but it ended up being a source of inspiration for a lot of young people around the world that were of color and watched, you know, this performance. And I got hundreds of messages from young people telling me that I was their hero because I wasn't afraid to be who I was in a setting as grand and important as that. And it just really, really pulled on my heartstrings because I wasn't trying to make a statement at all. It was just what my hair looked like at the time. But I knew in that moment that because I was Black, for better or for worse, I had an opportunity to use my platform to inspire people. And so that from that point on, I have been more conscious of everything.
Discuss a pivotal moment in your career and how it influenced your musical direction.
Okay, well, definitely recently, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, I starred in an opera called Intimate Apparel. And Intimate Apparel was actually adapted from a play by the same name by playwright Lynn Nottage. And Lynn Nottage was commissioned along with composer Ricky Ian Gordon to adapt the play into an opera. And it was a co-commission by the Metropolitan Opera and Lincoln Center Theater. And it ended up being the first of its kind where it was this kind of hybrid theater, straight theater piece, but also an opera. Metropolitan Opera did the casting for the leads, and Telsey, was Broadway casting agency, did the casting for the ensemble. And the creative team was Bartlett Scher and Jennifer Tipton and Michael Jurgen. And so basically a team of top-notch professionals, lighting designer, set designer, director, from both the Broadway and opera world. When we performed the piece, it ran like a Broadway show, meaning we had 8 performances a week, sometimes 2 in the same day. But it was still a full length opera. And we were still, you know, singing and performing like we always do in opera. And it was a huge challenge to do that many shows a week. But I think we all became better artists as a result. But also the fact that it didn't take place at the Metropolitan Opera, it took place at Lincoln Center Theater. And there were a few people that came to the first couple of performances that had no idea that it was an opera. They just thought they were going to see just play Intimate Apparel, because we actually had the benefit of having her as our librettist. So she was involved in the piece, but it wasn't her play. And we, you know, once we started singing, there were a few people that got up and left because they were like, what is this? But it really was an opportunity to kind of introduce opera to the theater community. And it was a special opportunity for us to be introduced to the theater community. And I think that we all became a lot more character-driven. Our acting became as much as important as our singing, because it just was in that particular venue, as intimate as it was, and just what the demands were from the piece, it being a theater piece in itself, that we kind of took all of the skills that we learned from that process back into our normal standard opera careers. And I think we've all benefited from it. And me working with contemporary composers, and I mean, I'm working on a contemporary opera right now at the Lyric Opera Chicago. I have another one coming up this summer in Des Moines. I just finished another contemporary opera at the Metropolitan Opera in Dead Man Walking by Jake Hagee. I'm premiering a new opera next season by Ricky Ewing Gordon and Lynn Nottage. All of this work, I think, stemmed from my experience and my time with Intimate Apparel.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Pivotal moment for me as far as my work and why I am so passionate about contemporary opera.
Talk about hobbies or interests outside of music that influence your creativity.
Okay, well, I don't know how much it influences my creativity, but it definitely my passion for sports, and in particular basketball, absolutely influences my work ethic and my discipline. A coach told me once that to be disciplined means that you do all the things that are hard and that you don't necessarily like to do, but you do them as if you love it. And that has helped me in my work ethic and my discipline within my musical career, my opera career, because sometimes learning music, learning roles is fun, and sometimes it's not so much fun. When you don't have ample time to prepare, it can be really stressful. And I think one of the things that helps me is being able to tap into a specific zone where any kind of discomfort or, you know, difficulty I encounter within learning my music or translating or memorizing, I just try to do my best to fall in love with the process, fall in love with the repetition, fall in love with dancing the words and dancing the music, and just finding different and creative ways to get the score in my body so that it lives within me, so that it comes out of me organically. And that's probably what I have taken the most pleasure and what I take most seriously from my athletic world.
What non-classical music or artists do you love, and why?
There are so many non-classical artists that I just adore. If I had to choose one, it would probably be Django Reinhardt, who is a jazz guitarist. He inspires me because the man is one of the most prolific and famous jazz guitarist in jazz history, and he has two fingers on his left hand. And a lot of people in that situation wouldn't try to play guitar. Because they're so limited in what the expectation is, and the repertoire that's out there could be really complicated, if not difficult, if not impossible to play with just two fingers on your left hand. But what he actually did was he created a technique for himself to be able to play his own style of jazz. And it became like a new performance practice to, you know, play in this style. He created a whole new style and became famous for it. And jazz guitarists to this day play in that style that he created out of necessity, you know? And that is so inspiring to me, because he just stayed true to who he was. And he's like, there's nothing I can do to have five fingers on my left hand. So I'm not going to try to mask or try to find ways to get around the fact that I have two fingers. I'm just going to create something new. And that really inspires me and has inspired me, because when I was younger and in college, I would idolize so many of my scholastic colleagues, particularly the baritones that I thought were so good. And it would get to a point where I would really get down on myself, because I would think, you know, I'll never sound like that. You know, I'll never be able to sing like they sing. And I would get discouraged. Reading about Django and hearing stories, you know, similar to his, made me realize that no, like I'll never be, you know, that baritone, but you know, they'll also never be me. I mean, there's only one me. What is special about me? What is that thing or those things that make me special? And when I discovered what those were and kind of leaned into those, then all of a sudden a world of opportunity, you know, presented itself to me. And I no longer wanted to be like anyone else. I just wanted to be me.
Yeah, that's cool. Very cool. Discuss a memorable experience in a different culture or country.
Okay. So probably I tell this story a lot. My parents tell it as well. When I was a child, I was a boy soprano. And I was one of those kids that I always knew I wanted to be an opera singer. It just gave me so much joy. And I thankfully showed promise early on. And my parents, you know, supported me and encouraged me to follow my dreams. But when I was young, I performed, and I performed a lot with my parents, and we were somewhere in Spain. I can't remember where we were, but we were in Spain, and we went out to like one of those open mic kind of places. And I got up. I wasn't shy then. I'm shy now, but I was not shy then. And I got up and I was really excited to sing my favorite song at the time. And my favorite song was Bésame Mucho. What I didn't realize at the time was Bésame Mucho is in Spanish. And at the time, I didn't know the real words to Bésame Mucho. I would make them up and everyone would love it, because I was a kid and when I was talking about it, I didn't even know what Bésame Mucho meant. But I just loved the melody. I thought it was, you know, romantic and exciting and just like awesome. And so I sang Bésame Mucho with made up Spanish, Spain, and everyone loved it. Everyone loved it. And I realize now that it took a couple of years that I realized hearing my parents tell the story that, oh my goodness, like I didn't know those words. That was probably so embarrassing. You know, It was a disgrace, you know, to their culture that I was just making words up. But in reality, these people fell in love with the fact that I fell in love with that song and I wanted to sing that song. And even though I didn't know the words, there was something that I understood about the spirit of the song. And there was something that I understood about music that they appreciated, especially at such a young age. And they just loved, they appreciated and admired my promise and my passion and my love for what I was doing. And even though I didn't know what I was doing, I knew that I loved music and they could sense that. So they celebrated. And I appreciate that story so much more, knowing that they definitely knew that I didn't know what I was talking about, but they appreciated the performance anyway.
Let's pause for a second. Are you an artist or work at an arts organization? I founded Gold Sound Media to help you expand your audience through social media. My team and I work closely with clients around the United States, directly shaping their messaging through customized strategic content. One of our biggest success stories is our work for the Clyburn, where we drove 25 million viewers, making it one of the most watched classical music events of all time. Get in touch to speak with me directly about how Gold Sound Media can help you. Just head to goldsoundmedia.com. Now, back to the show. Discuss your upcoming return to Carnegie Hall this March, and particularly discuss how this concert fits into the fall of the Weimar Republic Dancing on the Precipice Festival.
Yes, I am very excited to return to Carnegie Hall. I'll be collaborating with one of my favorite collaborators, Howard Watkins. And we are actually touring around the country, doing recitals all over. And one of our final stops is Carnegie Hall. And we are excited because with Carnegie Hall's festival, we get to be really creative with our repertoire and our program planning. And we have a program that is rich with Weimar era cabaret songs, with Kurt Weill, Robert Owens kind of political pieces. And we basically put a program together entitled Don't Be Angry. It's called Don't Be Angry. And I usually give performances and my primary goal is to give people to explore love, to share love, to give people an opportunity to come away from the troubles of the world. I wanted to do something a little different with this recital. I wanted to not shy away from the troubles of the world. I think it's a beautiful thing when art can be a vehicle for escapism. But I also think that art should reflect the times and should reflect what people are going through. And I think right now, a lot of people are angry. And I want to remind my audience that that's okay. It's okay to be angry sometimes. You know, sometimes you need to work through that anger in order to get on the other side of it. If you suppress it, if you ignore it, it's going to come back to haunt you every time. So I designed a program sort of celebrating the fact that I'm angry and you're angry and that's okay.
I don't think I've ever heard someone program a recital with that kind of thought or message. That's so interesting. Now, could you go into that a little bit more as it relates to Fall of the Weimar Republic, Dancing on the Precipice? Because I know that's Carnegie's festival, the name of it. And I know there's different events happening. And then your recital, from my understanding, is part of this overall festival that Carnegie's presenting. And I was reading about it, but why don't you summarize, at least to our audience, this whole idea of the Weimar Republic and the art that was being produced then. And then from my understanding, Carnegie's trying to take elements of what was happening in that period and kind of bring it over into the 21st century. Is that kind of what's happening?
Absolutely, yes. So a lot of my program are actually pieces from that Weimar period that were kind of a political satire, that were kind of calls to action, exploring the tyranny and fascism of the time. And so I have a nod to that. That's very much on the nose of that period, that kind of Berlin Germanic era of music. I also have programmed a sort of modern take, because I feel like we're going through a similar kind of time in our country now, where fascists, if you will, seem to be making a comeback. So I programmed Robert Owens song cycle entitled Motor Storm. And also I will be making a New York premiere of a song cycle that was written for me by composer Ricky Ian Gordon that we premiered together last year in Arizona, called Marvin Gaye Songs. And it explores the relationship between Marvin Gaye and his father, who famously killed him. And I think it was fitting to kind of explore this man who at one point in time loved his son through his own messed up thought process, and along with jealousy and along with substance abuse, ended up killing the thing that he loved the most. And that's sort of an allegory, if you will, for what I feel we are doing to our beautiful country, and as a whole, as a people, what we're doing to our world.
I get it. And so just as during this Weimar Republic period, where the artists were doing these works to kind of draw attention to what was happening politically, I suppose, right? In a way, then currently how you're performing and programming this is very much a reflection of what's happening in the world today.
Absolutely. Yes.
Tell us again, March, when is the concert at Carnegie? March 5th, Carnegie Hall. And I hope our listeners are going, because I think it would be wonderful to hear you. Kind of just bring this all together, leaving a legacy. How do you want to be remembered in the world of classical music, but also maybe just in the world at large?
Well, you know, I really want to be remembered as someone that pushed the envelope, but also gave credit where credit was due, and really respected the traditions that got us here. You know, I as I said before, I am a lover of contemporary music, but I don't think it's so separate from traditional music, because at one point in time, the music that we consider to be the classics, they were contemporary pieces at one point in time, you know? And so we have to continue to move the needle forward, and create new pieces and create new works, but also allow ourselves to understand how we got here and give respect to the beloved standard canon as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Post. If you loved it, give us a 5-star review as it helps us reach more people. Also, remember to hit that follow button in your podcast app to get notified of new episodes.